Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of August 19th, 2024. So on that note, I'll kick off with something I pulled from SecureList. It was the Tusk Info Stealer campaign, and it was referring to Kaspersky, their global emergency response team, something they kind of put together. And I think it's interesting just in general, as I just kind of look for materials, info stealers are coming up a lot more than I think they ever have. And I don't know if it's kind of what we were talking about in previous episodes about how, because how people use technologies, the use of cloud, SaaS, and also the whole Snowflake incident, maybe put a bigger sight when it comes to defenders and well as like criminals and offensive people as far as the value there. But this one specifically refers to the Tusk Info Stealer. And basically, they identified a complex campaign, which really consisted of multiple sub-campaigns. They were orchestrated by Russian-speaking cyber criminals. But the sub-campaigns imitate legitimate projects. And they slightly modify the names, branding, and they use social media accounts to increase the credibility of these places. But one of the things I think is really interesting with this whole write-up is the campaign-by-campaign kind of comparison you're able to do. Because one of the things I always love to focus on is what are the consistencies? Like, I obviously know that adversaries will learn new tricks of the trade, kind of add new tools or tool belt. But, like, what do they hold on to and repeat, and what do they replace? Like, that's always, I think, more fascinating, because I think when it comes to, you know, you can hunt or try to detect a million things and hope that you land on one, or you can find those few things that are the most reliable and have like a higher sense of confidence that you'd be getting more for your effort. So in this case, you know, what was interesting is when you end up downloading your initial payload, so when you end up going to like a malicious site, it looks at the user agent the site does, and then it determines what download links to basically offer your way if you're on a Mac system or Linux or Windows, whatever. I think the targets primarily are Mac and Windows. But then you download the initial payload. And what was interesting, too, is this is the first time I think I've seen it. I may have heard people talk about it, but I actually like seeing it firsthand. Is they wrote a local CAPTCHA to basically, you know, validate you as the user. And this is really just an attempt to avoid the automated sandboxing or analysis, because obviously if you drop a file somewhere and have a system run it, it's not going to, you know, do the CAPTCHA work for you to actually finish the installation detonation of these things. But once that initial payload is executed, it drops files into the temp directory, which is the user temp directory. And then it has some places, sometimes it's the MD5 of the executable, or it's in a directory that gets created called archive, you know, dash with some random string associated. And so, you know, that's the initial campaign. And what was interesting is you look across all the campaigns, that initial step is kind of just consistent. They're using some of the same directories, and they have kind of the same execution flow. Now, what's interesting is once that initial payload drops, it typically drops two other payloads that kind of do two different things. It unpacks and drops those in the same space. So, you know, now you're seeing executables being created by other executables in the same places where you wouldn't expect those things to be created or run from. And one of the things that is interesting that I always look for as a behavior is what executables or processes are actually executing command prompt, or in other cases, PowerShell too. But in this case, it's specifically command prompt, because when you have a non-system related thing executing command prompt, it's not like it's always malicious, but it enables especially for lower sophisticated code that's not leveraging APIs and has all this type of, you know, ways to do it. Like it's a shortcut way to get things done on a system, especially if you're a malware author. And so looking for weird paths for like the parent executable running CMD or PowerShell is always something good to look for. And in this case, that's kind of what's happening. And then what's also interesting, so that's a kind of a strong behavior, but as you go down the campaigns, you also see that now the same executable is able to run DLLs with run DLL32. So it's using run DLL32 to execute malicious DLLs that might pull down, or it's able to run MSIA execute to do like Microsoft install packages of maybe other malicious payloads as well. Both are also behaviors that are common that we look for as threat hunters on what is executing those things and like from weird parent directories. So that I like that was nice because you already had a behavior that we kind of are aware of, we look for some kind of times, but then when they start incorporating other behaviors, you start seeing that they're just using common techniques that other people have used or things that we should already be aware to be looking for. So this really had the whole theme for me of, hey, here's these few campaigns. They do the typical info stealing type stuff, but this is how the campaigns differ, and this is how they're the same. And there's just the common patterns that you'd be able to confidently look for some of those behaviors to say, hey, there's some interesting things we need to investigate further just by looking at a handful of things. So what was your take when you kind of looked across this?
Yeah, a lot of the similar points. I thought the CAPTCHA thing, so you hit it on the side where it was looking at evading, like sandbox evasion. But I also thought, I think it's dual threat. I think having that allows to provide some legitimacy, you know?
Yeah.
To kind of sell as like a legitimate program to a general user. That one stood out for me for sure. Another interesting thing I thought this article did well is given side-by-side comparisons of the mimicked sites they used for each of the three campaigns. And they were pretty good. So the mimics weren't bad. I could totally see how people would fall for those. I've seen some very terrible site mimics before. I know you have. But these ones are pretty good in this whole campaign. And there was some focus on that, it looked like. I think the other side, something else I thought about, and this is more of like a generalized hunting idea, circled around this before in the past where they were using Dropbox as the initial download site, right? So Dropbox is pretty widely trusted. And then there's other file share like sites like Dropbox out there that are pretty widely trusted. And I wonder how many companies have evolved into considering this in their environment, because these widely trusted ones you generally might leave open, or there might be some business use cases where you have to work with another entity or a vendor or something and leverage these. But from a generalized hunt idea, pulling the data to understand, you know, what your user base or how often your user base might be going to these types of sites and the activity around it is a pretty good high-level hunt in my mind, right? It's a good starting point to see what kind of nuggets you might uncover. Could be
able to look at like what initiated it. Was it like a redirect, or did you go actually from website to website, or did something randomly just call it, you know?
Right. And then when you consider this, not just, you know, not to going too far away from, you know, the point of this article, but you could uncover some insider threat type things too. People exfilling stuff out that they shouldn't, things like that. But that was a point that I really thought of, was that's a good generalized starting point for what could be, depending on your environment, a pretty complex hunt.
Yeah, agreed. So what do you have for the next topic of discussion?
All right. Let's start with the first one here. Is an article from Unit 42 titled "Leaked Environment Variables Allow Large-Scale Extortion Operation of Cloud Environments." So bear with me a little bit, a little wordy on this one, but I want to kind of hit some points. There was a lot of depth in this article from my perspective. I'm going to try to get at most of it. But Unit 42 identified an extortion campaign that successfully compromised multiple victims' cloud operations by leveraging exposed environment variable files, or .env files. Environment files allow users to define configuration variables used within the applications and platforms. And those files contain secrets like hard-coded cloud provider access keys, SaaS API keys, database login information, and the like. So the scope of the campaign, and I'm gonna read this one direct from the article. So quote, the campaign operation set up its attack infrastructure within various organizations' Amazon Web Service environments. And they used the groundwork to scan more than 230 million unique targets for sensitive information. This campaign targeted 110,000 domains, resulting in over 90,000 unique variables in the .env files. Of those variables, 7,000 belonged to organizations' cloud services, and they traced 1,500 variables back to social media accounts. Additionally, attackers used multiple source networks to facilitate the operation. So a couple nuggets in here. The initial access vector of the openly exposed .env files, which I kind of already mentioned, they would use the discovery API calls against IAM. Excuse me. The security token service, the STS or simple storage service, and simple email service or SES by basically running AWS versions of Who Am I, and that's called the get caller identity. So this would give the threat actor information about the account, like user ID, AWS account number, Amazon resource name, or ARN, which would give information about the IAM resource type, AWS associations, regions, etc. They would leverage that IAM created to create new resources. One in particular was called lambda.ex, and that would allow it to create various additional roles. So that Lambda service, for those that might not know, is a cloud-based computation service, and the threat actors deployed this service, allowing them to, like, within seconds, enable that same Lambda service on every region that the given account was associated with. So basically spiderwebbing computational services across that access they acquired. Then they would use that computation resource to automate a massive internet-wide scan with a pre-configured list of millions of domains and IP addresses. They would then they would exfiltrate the victim's S3 buckets, which contained all the information, all the information you would be worried about, and they would load a ransom note in that empty S3 bucket, letting them know they've been hosed, and begin the extortion process. And one of the other kind of high points, again, numbers are always stick out, is there here at the top six unique cloud and SaaS secrets that were stolen by the provider or by provider. So there was 1,185 AWS access keys, 333 PayPal OAuth keys, 235 GitHub keys, 111 HubSpot API keys, 39 Slack webhooks, and 27 DigitalOcean tokens. So there was a lot going on in this. And what I found interesting, Scott, and I'm really curious to see what you thought about it, was the leverage of automation that was used to accomplish this. So one, attacking the cloud service, it showed a very kind of high-scale knowledge of the AWS environment. And then for them to spiderweb out as fast as they were with automation, I thought was really interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they basically took advantage of the cloud capability once given the right level of access. What I love about this is we always get questions on, like, one, like, how do you hunt in the cloud? Or do you guys build hunts with the cloud? And yeah, one of the things I was tasked with, as well as someone else on the team, was looking at cloud-based attacks and what are the things we would look for. And what I love seeing is they did a great job of kind of going over what are some of the common API stuff being listed. And why that's important is if you've never looked at cloud data, all the interactions with the cloud, it's almost like the cloud itself is obfuscated by some application layer. Like, you know, you're never really touching hardware. You're never really touching the environment, but you're going to this application layer that sits in front that lets you manage and interact with everything in there. And so naturally, you have to use APIs that are configured to do specific tasks. And so that's where your visibility really is in the cloud for the most part. And, you know, as far as, you know, there's obviously some access pieces, but as far as what you can actually do as well within all the configuration pieces and what that leverage you can do, it's all there too via the API. And I loved how they had it. They talked through where they had the access one account that did not have the access they needed, and how they did privilege escalation was they were able to look at what kind of access did they have to IAM. And that's like the account management, right? That's how you manage, you know, all the accounts as well as all the privileges and everything. And they saw that as far as the access that account that they had compromised had was the ability to create a new account and also assign privileges to accounts. So they were able to create a net new account and then assign the appropriate privileges they need to achieve what they wanted to, which, you know, is always very interesting because basically if you have those privileges hanging around, you might as well be give that user admin privileges because there's only one step away. Granted, if you're looking for these things, maybe you could detect it. But it goes back to, I think the best defense in the cloud is really least privilege, but you have to know what that means. You know, one of the things that's interesting when you look at, say, a Windows domain environment, you know, there's probably very few people, probably myself included, that can tell you all the different controls and all the different access responsibilities, anything like that, that you can actually get for every single flag and every single setting within a Windows domain. So sometimes it's just based on just ignorance, things are secure because not everyone knows everything. Because, and I think part of that reason is how people interact with Windows directory environment is, you know, they've got a GUI, they can do things through PowerShell, you know, different command line options. You know, there's a multitude of different ways. And so your experience and expertise is based on how you've interacted with it. And so there's not this global knowledge. But when you look at the cloud, everyone interacts with the cloud basically the same way. There is a GUI, right? But the GUI has everything defined in it the same way. You can get to everything, see everything the same way. And then there's the command line, which is predominantly how a lot of administrators like to do mass things, especially attackers in that case. So I feel like understanding all the different caveats, and of course there's really good documentation, you know, Windows documentation, I feel like is trying to like backfill a lot of their documentation for some things. So there's just this level of understanding that attackers are going to have going against the cloud. For one, it's really easy for them to set up their own environment and play with things. There's really great documentation. And it's very easy to see the level of access that exists and what you can do with it by chaining things together. So I really liked all that. And I really liked how, even on the discovery side, they list out a ton of different API calls associated with the discovery for them to be able to pull all the information together that they did. You know, what was scary, though, is, you know, obviously when we talked about like at scale, what you're able to do with Lambda across all these environments. And, you know, Lambda is kind of like your automation in AWS for certain things, certain types of automation. Man, do they really maximize the use of that? It's like you said, it's kind of scary at the scale they're able to do that for something that is very, very simple. And that's what I think is interesting, is it highlights the potential and power of the cloud and what you can achieve there. But yeah, if you don't have things guarded the right way, you really can hose yourself pretty quickly. And so I think in the cloud environment, it's a perfect example of where almost want to add privileges as you go and not just take away what you think they don't need, right? Because that helps you avoid situations like this. As far as learning how to, what to hunt for, what to group by as far as activities, especially from single accounts, great list of API names. And then what's great is if you actually test some of these things within the environment, you can kind of also see what does that look like from all the different options associated with these, what options may be more impactful, what options would you care more about, as well as, you know, the API itself too. So there's a lot of things to learn there, but it was a great write-up because you don't see a lot of them done this way with the cloud-based attacks.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, just a 2-second weekly soapbox, it feels like at this point, is the, you know, I still firmly pay attention to your environments. Make sure you look under the hood. It feels like these were easily preventable attacks, right? Having those kind of files exposed like they were, and those kind of environments exposed like they were, to me, that just harkens back to the whole, you know, speed to market and security was an afterthought.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. I do think, well, I'm trying to remember now, but you know, when you create things natively in the cloud, I feel like a lot more things are created with least privilege-ish, but I don't think to the scale where we've learned from like historic events, right? You know, there was a point in time where we always questioned as security professionals, like, hey, why when I buy something does it not have all the security bells and whistles just enabled by default versus I have to enable all the things I want to secure, because we should really approach things from the let's do the most secure first and see if we can back off in some instances. Now, I know they of the operations and time to market and things like that, that does kind of have to find that balancing act. Right. But, you would think that there are some privileges that even AWS should flag as, you know, these can be used against you or high, you know, these are what I would put in this bucket. And they have, I think, predefined profiles that helps with that. But still, like I said, least privilege is your best defense in the cloud for a lot of the settings.
Agreed.
Yeah, kind of rambled there for a little bit, but we'll change gears. And the other article I wanted to hit on, it was a Talos Intelligence blog, right? This Chinese hacking group, APT41, compromised Taiwanese government-affiliated research institute with Shadowpad and Cobalt Strike. This was interesting because, you know, you're looking at, obviously, attacks that I would say, and the kind of the running theme when I was looking at the articles, by the way, was look at all these really cool things these attacks do, but there's going to be that one or two things that you can almost detect every time. It's like they can't go completely undetectable, right? In this case, you know, they kind of talk through the different tools they use, the kind of the sophistication. It looked like they kind of had written some of their own stuff within Cobalt Strike itself. So they had a good understanding of how Cobalt Strike worked. And then they talked about, you know, the different type of foothold establishments, where they had the web shell, where that drop looked like, as far as the files and locations, and also with if they had RDP access, what did that drop look like for their tool sets, and then obviously reverse shell drops as well. So they kind of walk through all those. And then what's interesting is you look at Shadowpad. Shadowpad's an interesting loader because it kind of does like it does DLL side loading, you know, takes legitimate executables and then puts in their own malicious payload. But it also looked like in some instances where it almost did like a double DLL side loading technique, which I didn't dig in too much, but some of the graphics and some of the stuff, it looked like there was like a multiple, like a chained event. So it wasn't your traditional, but either way, you're leveraging that type of loader for a lot of the things, which is considered to be a little better at, you know, beating a lot of defenses. And then they're also, you know, using Cobalt Strike. So, you know, tools that we at least know about, understand. And so they talk about, you know, the level of success they had. But when I talk about things that are identifiable, you know, just in dropping and pulling down their tools, they're leveraging PowerShell to do, you know, the typical new object system net web client to download, you know, parts of their tools as well as scripts and things to enable themselves. And so this is always interesting because it looks like, and I would guess this happens more on the early end of the attack. So when you think about the kill chain, you know, this is the delivery of tools. This is in some cases additional access based on these actions. And these are easily identifiable. Also, when you're looking at for things like this, it's easy also to discern if it's legitimate or not. And in this case, you know, there's some other additional nuances. Like for instance, you have single named PowerShell scripts, right? Or sorry, single character named PowerShell scripts, which any single character file, in my opinion, is always suspicious in this day and age because we just see it, bring it up all the time. They had direct callouts to IPs, which is, you know, I would say not as standard anymore either, especially from PowerShell pulling things down that would be highly suspicious. They also have, you know, the encoded commands in PowerShell, which we do see on some legitimate management based things, but something that is easy to identify. And so with the combination of all these things in the early stage, like I kind of don't care that they have these other types of toolkits to try to figure out how am I going to discover these toolkits, where I would rather identify the threat with this initial easy to find detectable type of part. And then as part of my investigation, use all the context of they use Cobalt Strike, they use Shadowpad, they use all these things to say, okay, that is my way to validate if I find anything, versus kind of working the other way. Like sometimes I feel like people take the hard things first because they're the most telling if you can find it. And then they use the simple things to validate it, right? And I feel like, you know, you end up spending more effort cycles and may not have the same amount of success. So, you know, that's kind of my big takeaway from looking at some of the things that were going on in this campaign that I would say are worth learning from. And it, you know, it's just a small section of the actual report itself that I'd be utilizing for that as well. So what was your big takeaway when you saw something like this?
Yeah, you know, spot on with the whole, you know, track the door. Did they get through the door before you're looking at the six layer down move of their attack, right? It can simplify your approach and scale back on everything. That's a great point, Scott. One of the things that I thought was really interesting on this, and I don't know if it's just, you know, time spent or just thinking about it differently, looking at articles like this and looking for some of those kind of little nuggets that are, hey, wait a minute, this flashes it. So you see a lot in the article where it talks about, you know, the techniques they use to do the side loading, to try to do AV avoidance. They're relatively newer techniques, I'd say, last couple of years kind of thing. You see that they're using. Mm-hmm. But then inside of that, where they have a payload, they drop something that I pulled out of this, an additional hacking tool that would come with this to do local privilege esque. And it was a very specific tool focused at a vulnerability from 2018 for the Microsoft comm for Windows called Unmartial. And what made me wonder here, and I missed it when I first went through this and I need to dive back into that article, or it just wasn't necessarily mentioned, is why would a group go through a sophisticated approach like this to deploy something that aged, unless they perhaps knew their target had that vulnerability in them? Which then, you know, necessarily that doesn't necessarily surprise, but it's something to look a little deeper in. It's more of a game theory in my head, right? You know, a China actor going after a research facility, you know, that's, you know, follows protocol, right? But they're very sophisticated. So, you know, my first thought was when they attempted this attack, they had more visibility into their target than was necessarily let on with the article. I don't know. What do you think about that?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It made me think of two things. One, you know, they dropped some PowerShell scripts and executed those. I wonder if that had anything to do with, like, what discovery next steps they may try. But the other thing is kind of, I was reading a brief article and I thought about bringing it up here, but basically the topic is around how we really, like, sensationalize or give way more credit due to cyber attackers as if, like, they're some super villain, right? And, you know, they say you look back over time, a lot of these people are either just really persistent or lucky, right, to be successful. And they're oftentimes not doing anything groundbreaking. They're just using really old stuff that is still works. And that kind of made me think of that as well, right? Because, you know, to look brilliant in the room, just know more about the topic or a topic the least amount of people know. You know more than everybody else in the room, and it's a topic that not very many people know much about. You'll always look smart in that scenario. And when it comes to attackers, I feel like they always look really smart because, you know, they may be in the game longer. They may know a few things a lot better than a majority of the IT or tech folk. But when you actually put them toe-to-toe with a lot of defenders, like the defenders are way more brilliant in most cases, right? They have to know so much more to be good at their job. In some cases. So I don't know, it's kind of one of those things where I feel like, you know, we have this expectation that, man, they really know what they're doing. And, you know, thinking a couple steps back, like maybe they just got lucky, or maybe it was just like they tried that because that usually is successful. And then since it worked, they didn't move to the next thing that was a 2019 vulnerability they tried. You know, like, I mean, so.
You're right on that too, right? Like the defender has a lot of doors to watch and the attacker just needs to get through one, right? So,
right. So, and like depending on how many ways they knock, I mean, there's nothing really holding them back. And especially since most of the time, vulnerabilities are not where, or exploitation of vulnerabilities are not where a lot of detections are built.
Right.
Because it's kind of like, in a way, a wasted effort, because you can patch away most of those vulnerabilities and that's how you address them. It's not about leaving things vulnerable and detecting when they're used. So that's why a lot of the focus is, okay, that happened. So they may get further in their attack chain because they use the exploit. Now they start doing other activities that can be detected as well. So
Yeah.
So yeah, it's always interesting when I see that, because, you know, you and I have worked with people in the past and said that, yeah, people, you know, at least back then when, you know, the operating systems were not what they are today, they were what, I think 2000 or Windows 7. And they're like, yeah, they're still using things from, you know, 1997 to break in. Right. And it's just like, and it wasn't like anything fancy. It was just like, they understood this one protocol worked and no one really defended it properly. You know? So,
yeah, for sure. Okay.
Cool.
Well, jumping into my next item for the week. So this is from Elastic Security Labs. It's called Beyond the Whale, Deconstructing the Banshee Info Stealer. There's that word again, Scott, Info Stealer. I feel like we're going to be talking about this a lot forever.
It was ransomware for a while, right? But now I feel like Info Stealer is kind of taking a lot of the spotlight.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the key things that I thought was interesting reading on this is, by and large, you don't get a whole lot of stuff, at least in comparison, you don't get a whole lot of stuff that's Mac targeted versus Windows.
Yeah.
And this stealer is specifically Mac OS targeted. And it's recent, it's newer. So identified, per this article, is identified this month. So it's a dynamic info stealer built in C++, a malware, allowed for manual input, so there could be somebody on the other end actually configuring how they wanted to use this thing. It targets a wide range of browsers, cryptocurrency wallets, and one of the interesting points that I thought was it actually goes after around 100 different browser extensions that it wants to collect data from. So it makes it pretty versatile, pretty dangerous, again, targeting Mac OS. The stealer would do a lot of common things like check for logging and debugging in the system, verify it wasn't in a virtual environment or sandbox, would check the system preferred languages, make sure they were not Russian. So that gives a strong indicator that the threat actor themselves were Russian. And when it was successful, would steal common information, user creds, browser data. One of the other things I found interesting is it actually went after and looked for 9 different browsers. That was an interesting nugget for me. A couple that I wasn't hyper familiar with, actually. And and then it also steals the notes database, and then files with, there was like 11 or 12 different extensions from the desktop and documents folders, like .txt, .doc, .wallet, things like that. The particular interesting piece to me, I thought, was it was built to go and look to steal data from the browser extensions, too. So having that kind of list and focus, I thought, was interesting. We talked about this a bit last week with the browser extension, so I don't want to kind of like totally re-harken it, but it was new to me, like, to go after things like that. But makes sense. And then, like, a good little stealer would exfil all the collected data. But very high level, we can dive more into it, Scott. But I want to see what you thought first. To me, this one stood out. Oh yeah, also too, the one of the things that was interesting, and I wondered if this was because it was very well designed for Mac OS. So the Banshee Stealer is actually out there, and they're charging $3,000 a month for this, which is significantly higher than what you see charged for other stealers to be leveraged or bought on the dark side of things. But yeah, what do you think, Scott?
Yeah, so it's interesting when you look at Mac based stuff, because the one thing that always stands out the most is like the discovery stuff, because I just assume that people don't run a lot of discovery type commands on Mac machines versus like Windows, because a couple different reasons. This might be a dig at Windows, but I feel like there's less troubleshooting that happens, where you would have an admin doing all sorts of crazy discovery to try to figure out why something isn't working, especially for your average user. What's that?
I said, man, low blow. I think you're right, though. Just, you know.
Right, like I feel like how people use Macs and what it takes to administer Macs is different. So when you look at those common system utilities being run, what's interesting is you look at like some Windows programs, they're constantly using Windows system utilities to do different functions for their own program. I feel like Mac, it's not, you don't see that much the same, but I don't know. Like I said, I don't dig into Mac data that much, but I do pay attention to the attacks. And so the discovery pieces are always interesting. So anything with the system call and, you know, collect system info and some other commands you can do there will always stand out. And I think your call as far as, you know, checking what the location is, I think that's the one advantage. You know, we know that a lot of cyber criminals are kind of harbored in like the safe haven of being behind Russia's borders, because Russia has a great agreement. Like, hey, do what you want to do, just don't attack us. And in a way, they get benefits. They create a stability across the rest of the world. And they also protect themselves because they know they've incentivized not to be attacked. So it for them, it's actually a great move. But for the rest of the world, one thing that's nice about that is these cybercrime adversaries know this so well that they don't want to, you know, cross that line, right? And so they're going to use a multitude of different ways to figure out where you may possibly be located to make sure you're not on the no-hit list. And so just knowing that, you should be paying attention to, like, you know, they use curl to hit the free IP API to basically get the public IP address of where the host could possibly be. And then they can probably do the geo lookup as well to say, yeah, that's a target we can go after, right? You know, and certain, depending on the OS, you can determine language packs and things. So all that is good information, knowing that like a majority of the cybercrime kind of has to follow those tenets. It's kind of like their SOP. And so they don't always do it, but it's always a good thing to be looking for. How are the different ways that I can, you know, figure this out? You know, what are the different services and open web services that you can, you know, touch from the infected host to be able to determine that? And so I think those are just really great indicators that there's something abnormal going on, which is always your first tip. Once you figure things, something's weird going on, usually finding everything else is simplified considerably.
Yeah, for sure. It's a wonder too, you know, and maybe it's just the not care, but it seems like you almost kind of key yourself up for easy attribution by, you know, allowing those kind of clear nuggets. It's just a random thought that's on the top of my head.
Well, because you're not worried about the attribution because you have protections. I feel like that helps. But then again, like if the attribution gets down to you at the personal level, like I hope you enjoy, for instance, living in Russia the rest of your life, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
You do kind of limit some things for yourself by not caring. But maybe you're okay with that, right? Personally, like, I would have other concerns if that were the scenario, but yeah.
Yeah. It was very cool. Very interesting. I like seeing stuff that's coming out for these types of systems. You know, we don't generally face it. So it's a new type of challenge to consider and think about. You know, Mac is different from Windows, and it was cool to see some live fire stuff coming at it.
Yeah. So the next one I was going to pull up is more of a thought piece, right? It was one of the HelpNet security where they pull off like a report or a summary of data from a report to talk about a specific topic. In this case, it was AI. And the title of the article is really 74% of IT professionals worry AI tools will replace them. But really right below that is when they were talking about 56% of security professionals are concerned about AI powered threats. And so it was really kind of to have that conversation. Like, obviously, as they run through the article, they talk about how, you know, what organizations are actually doing formal training for their people to understand how AI kind of works or how to use AI effectively or whatever. But, you know, I think maybe that also sheds some of the light on the worry, maybe where people think the tools will replace them. But, and then they talked about, you know, out of some of the skill sets, even when you look at what AI may be able to help with. They didn't mention that. I thought this was interesting when they said 75% of the respondents indicated that threat intelligence and reverse engineering were the most valuable advanced cybersecurity skills of today, while 24% noted that threat hunting were among the other skills, were among these skills, sorry, which is cool because, like, I do think threat hunting should be on the list because it offers more intimate level of defending than just, hey, we just need to find something that alerts and then respond to it. You know, what's interesting is, just the conversation piece around AI and that whole, like, they're worried or, you know, worried about threats that AI can bring. I mean, this is kind of the theme with any new technology and just not understanding the technology well enough. I mean, the cloud was the same thing. And yeah, cloud attacks happen. But when you think about the most costly attacks, it's ransomware not hitting the cloud. It's hitting people's environments, right? So even though the cloud exists and it's supposed to be this, you know, future rich environment to attack, there's still way more lucrative attacks and way more successful attacks not happening in those spaces. And then when it comes to the AI piece, you know, the other thing that people kind of lose sight on is when you're attacking, like we just talked about Mac and we just talked about Windows, when you're attacking a system, there's probably 90% of how that system operates has guardrails that are really hard to get around. So you have to do things a certain way. But in order for you to understand what those things are, you have to be well informed how things work. And so, yeah, there's going to be that 10% of where, oh, there was this, you know, vulnerability or a zero day or something where something unintended happened. No one can protect against that, right? Like, that's just the, how do we manage when something like that does come out to respond? Or how do we catch something that utilized something we don't know about down the chain so that we can respond, walk it back, and maybe discover those things? And that's why, this is where I segment to, like, why I love the concept of threat hunting over some traditional security things is, you don't really take anything away if I give you a list of IOCs. Like, you have nothing to gain from an IOC as far as what can you do to bolster your knowledge. If I give you a hash or give you an IP, maybe you can look up some context about it and do some research, but you're not learning anything new. But when I say, hey, there is this way to run, you know, this tool that will download and execute, like you Bits admin to pull down and execute something. Well, all of a sudden, when you try to look and defend against that behavior and hunt for it, you're going to understand, well, what is Bits admin? What are all the different flags associated with Bits admin? How do you download and then execute? What are the constraints? How hard is it to actually utilize? And how easy is it to break, or whatever those things are? So you end up walking away from that conversation or walking away from that effort, knowing more about how things work. And I feel like even if AI is able to increase the where people are attacking more, or able to help kind of create more nuances within some attacks, as long as you understand what's between those guardrail, that 90% well, doesn't matter who's attacking. They're attacking the same system with the same ways that things are supposed to operate. And until they can break those boundaries, which, by the way, most of the time when you break those, you also break the system. So they are still kind of rare cases. But even then, AI gets into a system. Is AI going to walk everything to the finish line? You know, today, I don't think so. So I'm not really worried about that. They may help with pieces of the attack, mostly on the social engineering side, which we've talked about before. But I really think that's what it comes down to. I think a lot of this fear is uncertainty than it is actual validated. So I was kind of curious your thoughts on, you know, that whole argument of, like, should we really be worried, and should people really be stressing about this? And, you know, is this the right scale of scope and visibility that people are putting on it?
Yeah, I feel like we could probably hold a whole show with AI, probably multiple shows, right? It's a cool topic. It's hot and heavy right now. It's buzzword worthy, right? You know, for me, I kind of fall to the side when we talk about AI in this generalized sense. And I feel like we need to start, you know, really as an industry to, like, categorize it and put what you're...
Because there are very different things.
About. Correct.
Yeah.
So, like, in the idea, in the sense that you're talking about, I think it's, you know, spot on. I think worrying about the attack surface stuff is still the same, and that's not really changed yet. But I do think the use from a threat actor side to leverage AI tooling is going to amplify the amounts and the scale of attacks they can accomplish, because they will need less manpower to accomplish it, right?
Yeah.
So what I think the real threat is getting bombarded in ways you might not have considered, right? And the inverse of that on the defensive side is to, you know, I think it even talks about it in this article near the end, where, you know, what you really want to do is make sure that you're learning as this technology is evolving in your industry, and you're staying abreast to what it can do for you and how you can leverage it to mitigate that scale of what the adversary might throw at you. I don't think we're in a place now where somebody's going to drop an AI tool inside of your environment. It's just going to go do its thing. We could get there at some point, you know, but that's not what we're talking about right now. What we're talking about, you know, that's where categorizing it would help. I think it would also help people, you know, that might have been in this statistical study or this study where they got these percentages from, alleviate some of their stress. Like, don't panic. Put it in its place. You know, this is what you're looking at facing. How are you guarded against it? Where are your gaps? Where do you need to get better and understand how to leverage AI for yourself to detect these things, right? Where is the, you know, a lot of vendors are splashing AI on everything now, right? Where do those tool sets, what do they add to the value other than two letters and a buzzword? And just kind of putting those pieces where they need to be. So it's all alignment for me when I read this. I'm optimistic from my side of the house about AI. I think it's the tooling that's out there now is very valuable. It can help enhance what you're trying to accomplish, help you get there faster, help you get more detailed, allow you to remove some of the monotony so you can put in the bigger picture thoughts into action faster. And the threat actors are doing the same thing. So that, you know, that's kind of where I stood. I think really just putting everything in its place with this can alleviate the stress, which it seemed like there was a pretty high number of people fearful that they were going to lose their jobs over this. I don't think that's the case personally, especially from
I feel like it should make you better at your job.
It should help enhance you, correct? Yeah, you should get more efficient, faster with some of the stuff that 5 years ago might have been complex for you, like threat hunting, right? So some threat hunting 5 or 10 years ago, we know personally, right? We can go back to experiences where we were given a list of 100 IP addresses. These things were terribly bad, but we had no idea why, and we had to go figure out if they were, what they were doing, all of that, right?
Yeah.
Fast forward, you can take something simple like that and apply this new tooling to get to a decision point faster. And that's where that human comes in to make the decision of what's left or right for you, for your environment, and all of those. So yeah, it's just like, we got to start putting AI in its lanes when we're having these conversations and stop with the generalization, and we can alleviate that stress, take advantage of the tooling. You know, there's a lot of thoughts on this one, but I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, it's interesting. We started talking about like how AI can, you know, bring attackers to maybe to scale. But then I also thought about like, remember DGA? Like, I remember like people were like, oh, that's so advanced. Like, you know, domain generating algorithm, they put in their malware to roll the C2s, you know, on a certain time frame, like minute, second, whatever you want it to be. And it was like, how are you going to keep up or whatever? And it was like, you take that step back and you're like, we actually don't care where they communicate. Like, one, it'll help us validate when they're spewing out a bunch of stuff, and maybe we can build detections around that. I know people spent resources on trying to reverse engineer what's the DG algorithm so we can predict via IOC what the next one will be so that we can detect it. And you look at it and you're like, but they're doing the same. What, like, once they have that foothold, I don't care how they're talking out, they're still doing those actions I can detect internally that I walk back to that anyway. So it became a null point. Or a moot point in some regard, right? But like, when I then start thinking about AI and how it could really enhance and where it becomes more of a full-fledged attack, like, think what Cobalt Strike and Metasploit and, you know, Sliver and all these like C2 frameworks that enabled you to basically kind of, once you get your foothold, kind of own the environment, move through the environment, do certain things within the environment from like a centralized, managed, collaborative type thing. If you had some sort of AI built tool like that, then I would be a little more concerned, right? You basically just make it super easy to say, hey, I want to go from this point to this point. And they don't even have to know how to laterally move, how to get the right credentials, how to dump whatever, right? They can just say, oh, okay, you want to go there to there? Cool. I know how to do that on the back end. Now you're there. Now what do you want to do? Almost like to choose your own adventure from the attacker perspective. Like that would be more concerning, and not from the ability to be able to detect that, but if you don't have a common tool with the same speed to say, hey, we see this, block this, and you have to manually go into systems to try to block and stop things, and it's really just a command prompt, someone is just to tell the AI what to do, you're at a disadvantage based on speed, right? So that's where I can see where it becomes concerning, but nothing is, I would say, close to that today. And if people are trying to build that, that's kind of a cool capability, but there's a lot of gotchas there too. So it would stay in its infancy, I'd say, for quite some time. So like you said, even on the defense side, like that's where we should be thinking defensively. Like, how would I have maybe a SOAR platform that is AI managed, right? Or, you know, implemented in a way where SOAR isn't no longer, I have to program all the automations. I just have to tell the AI what I want to achieve. And once it's able to achieve it, I can tell it was successful, we're good to go. You know, like that would be really cool from the defensive side. So, but I feel like that's what would be interesting is how you get there. And the other thing to consider is training AI models, right? Like from the defense side, we usually have a lot of really good access and resources amongst ourselves and within the community. I know there's like the underground, but I don't think the underground's harvesting data to help train and attack models, right? The defense side is doing more of that. So another problem when it comes to AI, you can't just all of a sudden have built something smart. It needs a lot of data and information to become smart. So yeah, kind of my last two cents, I guess.
Yeah, and it was cool too that the article did mention and talk about it. So this is something I agree with, and it's perfectly in line with what you're saying, is that 34 of the respondents of this study suggested that cybersecurity data scientists are going to become more mainstream in the near term. I think that's spot on, because data is just increasing, right? The volume of data, and being able to, the key thing there is when you look through all of this. So if you look at your data scientists, you look at like DevSecOps, red team, threat hunters, anything, engineers, the whole general point is to get to a point of decision making, right? That's really oversimplifying it, but stay with me for a second at that very high level. The goal of all of these people unified together in an environment to defend it is to bring information to a decision point, right? This happened. We found this. This occurred. These chain of events happened. We need to make a decision on what to do in our environment to stop, mitigate, take action, et cetera. So leveraging tooling that is superior than somebody just sitting their hands on keyboard to help you get to that decision point faster is going to be instrumental in making you just better at it overall and being able to make and find more detailed things faster. But I think there's even a hidden layer there, so that if you can increase that capability, the ability to tie in with the rest of your company to get to a place where security defenders are able to help better make decisions on how to secure an environment overall, you stop chasing the bad things happen, you start working towards that proactive kind of step, right? So just something, just my last two notes too.
No, you bring a good point though. I want to hit on is, I think when you talk about, you know, 34% be cybersecurity data scientists, you know, you've got 22% possibly being exploit developers, 16% red team operators, 10% threat hunters, and then 4% ICS SCADA security. All that says to me is, yes, with new technology come challenges, but also opportunities, and the modern SOC needs to change.
100%.
Right? Like, 100%. You know, like we're going to be stuck in this paradigm where we're like, man, what we're doing just isn't really working anymore. It's like, yeah, because we're using the same model and the same talent structures and the same whatever of the past trying to solve future's problems. And I think the big takeaway here is, you know, this technology is here. It's not just coming and it's going to mature, but to really protect and evaluate and defend your risks. I said defend and protect in the same sentence probably because it's the most important part. You're going to need different talent and different approaches because technology is changing. And you're not going to be able to just put an analyst waiting for IOCs to hit on a board and then respond accordingly. You need to be more intelligent than that. So, yeah, that's a good point. So if you got nothing else, I think I'll close it out here. Just want to really thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of August 19th, 2024. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.